Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney. You're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, Red One, the world's first large format digital camera with integrated recording, ultra high definition in the palm of your hand, 2540p 60, up to 120 frames per second at 2K. Use your super 35mm lenses. Record onboard with Red Drive and Red Flash, the quality of 35mm and convenience of a camcorder. Modular and upgradable, four channels of audio, uncompressed, built-in resolution LCD with exposure and focus assist, Red's viewfinder with its innovative surround view, which allows you to view outside of the captured frame. All of that in a 7 pounds rugged magnesium alloy body.
No way.
That is the voice of Red Digital Camera at the launch at NAB at about 9:03 on the first morning. Hi, it's Mike Seymour, and you're listening to FX Guide's podcast for May 2006. Why is the Red camera so prominent? Why is it featured so much in the hot products from NAB? And certainly, why have we had an interest in it? I think it comes down to two points. The Red camera has lifted the bar in terms of capture, both in terms of the frame rate that it will record at and the resolution that it's recording at while doing a very high dynamic range of imagery. And it's done it all for an exceptionally low price. Going into NAB, this camera was hyped. This camera was hot. Coming out of NAB, it was... I just think it could be hotter. The thing that I've obviously stirred the most interest, it's 4K at high frame rates such as 60 frames per second or 2K at 120 frames a second. But it's doing all this for $17,500. We caught up with Ted Schulowitz, who is the, quote, leader of the rebellion, that's on his business card, leader of the rebellion, from Red Camera, and asked him a few questions about the Red Camera. We did this in response to the emails we got and the feedback from the podcast we were doing in Vegas. Firstly, we got heaps of feedback saying how much people liked the Roundtable podcast, and we'll be doing more of those, but also from people saying, could you go into a bit more depth on the Red Camera? Could you be a bit more critical about it and discuss some of the pros and cons of whether it's viable? So before we do that, let's hear a bit more of that opening presentation made on the first morning of NAB when the cover was taken off the Red camera for the first time and they launched to the world not only what it was capable of but how they were going to pull it off.
Red changes that landscapes dramatically. At the heart of Red lives the Mysterium sensor. Here's what the Mysterium sensor is about. 4,520 pixels wide by 2,540 pixels tall, you get data to burn. Data to burn. As you know, dynamic range is the difference between the maximum and the minimum amount of light that the device can accurately record with detail. And it is often an issue when you shoot digital cinema, because image sensors aren't sensitive enough to capture the brightest and the darkest at the same time without clipping, losing data. It's not an issue here. Mysterium boasts a greater than 66 dB signal-to-noise ratio, thanks to its large 29 square micron pixels, the result in exceptional dynamic range much closer to film, estimated to be between 11 and 15 stops in digital image acquisition. A very different digital filmmaking experience.
So as you heard there, the key to the camera is the CCD, obviously, in the pickup. And there they've produced this. Actually, it's interesting. Not only has it got a really interesting new CCD inside it, but actually that's been designed to be modular from the outset. So it's actually possible to replace this CCD if the guys come out with a new one later. But the camera that it's the Red One, which is the first presumably camera from the company, ships with this particular sensor, which is capable of doing 4K. So 4K is pretty remarkable, and it's actually slightly above 4K. And the guys pointed out that in a normal stills environment, you know, obviously megapixels, a HD camera in the normal stills environment would be called a 11.2 megapixel camera. Just as a stills camera, this would be an 11.4 megapixel camera. So that's equivalent to what you would see shot for magazine layouts. but it's doing that at up to 60 times a second. So a couple of uses of this, for example, when you combine it with the fact that it's got about 11 to 15 f-stops range of light values, instead of taking a camera out to do a light probe and wanting to do an HDR light probe that is sampling at one moment in time a wide dynamic range of imagery at high res, this would be capturing an entire scene in real time. If you obviously stick a wide fisheye lens on it, it would be sampling a HDR environment in real time with about 11 to 15 stops of latitude. So as the lighting changed, you'd actually be getting a real-time HDR updating file. Other uses, obviously, you can do it at 2K, and at 2K resolution, you have two options there. Either you can film at effectively 4K and it down-reses to 2K, or you sort of window onto that sensor and only use the middle of it, in which case you're doing 2K with this windowing option. At 2K resolution, you're now able to run at 120 frames a second. So if you think of traditionally 24p as being, you know, the benchmark for HD, these guys are doing 120p, and that's pretty remarkable. So they're running five times the resolution of a full HD 1080p camera, and they're doing that five times resolution at a vastly higher frame rate. Now, a lot of this stuff is possible because of this sensor. And, of course, one of the things you want to see is, you know, the images that this sensor produces. At the moment at NAB, they're not showing images from the sensor, though privately they said they had them all working and stuff. They just weren't willing to go to the public yet and have shots that people could analyze. The sensor itself is about 24 by 13 mil, which means it's the size of Super 35. Now, why is that significant? Well, the big thing when HD cameras first came out was that they had a smaller CCD. They had a CCD about the size of 16mm film. So think about this for a second. You're capturing at high res, but the actual thing that you're aiming the lens at is pretty small, which meant the initial HD lenses had to be better quality than 35mm. So if you look at, say, Panavision, they came out with the range of digital primos. Now, those lenses that the Panavision guys had, which were used on Star Wars, great lenses, but they had to be about 2.5 times the quality or clarity or ability to resolve that a normal 35mm lens had. So Panavision were making a large, very large range of lenses, but one of the set of those lenses were these huge HD digital primos, because compared to a lens that would go on a Millennium, which is, you know, the top of the line Panavision camera, these lenses had to sort of resolve to a much, much smaller little footprint. Imagine a picket fence in front of a house. If that picket fence has a lot of vertical lines that you're filming, you obviously want those to show up really clearly. And if that has to be resolved down to something about the size of 35mm film, it requires a certain level of accuracy. It has to be aimed at something a quarter of that size, which was 16mm, then, you know, the lenses had to be so much better. Which is why 16mm film never tends to look as good as 35. The first problem is, you know, it's obviously less film, but the second problem is the lenses would actually have to be better in the case of 16mm than 35, not cheaper, and so you were getting a double hit. So 16mm film was getting a hit from smaller film and effectively worse lenses. Even if the 16mm lens was the same grade as the 35 lens, it would still be suffering. Then came the HD lenses, and again, same problem happened. You'd get a lens that was rated to be as good as a 35mm lens, but because it needed to resolve to something smaller, the image quality would be poorer. Then they came out with HD, and we saw in that with, for example, the top-of-the-range stuff that's coming out now from a bunch of companies, including Panavision, which films were shot in, like, for example, Superman at the moment. Superman is shot on the Genesis camera. Now, the Genesis from Panavision has a CCD that is about the size of 35mm film. Consequently, the Genesis will take any 35mm lens and it will resolve it with the same degree of accuracy, and that's all it needs to produce at. Now, the Genesis, of course, is an incredibly expensive camera. So now we run the clock forward to the RED camera, and you're talking about the same thing. You're saying, in this camera, if they produce it the way they're saying, we'll be able to attach a normal 35mm lens to it. So if somebody was wanting to do an indie production, they might have their own camera back, which is the camera itself, the main RED One camera, and they could just go and hire any 35mm lenses, and that would be producing superb image quality. And so the fact that the sensor is big is a really, really big deal. The fact that the sensor can also record a wide dynamic range is a big deal. And the fact that the camera has the architecture to have that happening at a very high frame rate is a big deal. And if that wasn't enough, then came the price. The RED camera was only $17,500 for the body, and they indicated, for example, that a 300mm lens would be about $4,750. Now, we'll come back to that in a second, but the base RAW camera, no lenses, not even a viewfinder, no accessories, was $17,500. And you'd expect that to be with a zero missing. You'd expect it to be like $170,000. So why do it? Who's doing this? Who's behind the RED camera? Let's hear what they said on the opening day.
This isn't your conventional camera manufacturer. This is more like a garage operation, but the most exotic and well-equipped garage you will ever see. It is the result of the founder of Oakley and mad scientist, Jim Jannard, whose passion for motion picture and discontent with the current offerings drove him to build a dream come true for filmmakers around the world.
Well, some garage operation. Of course, Oakley's known for its sunglasses, and that was initially some concern to some people. Well, how come a sunglasses company is making cameras? Well, actually, they have a optics division, and so it's actually no surprise that they're getting into high-level optics. And, of course, the camera is really about the optics, and that's what matters. The question is then, why come out at such a price point, and is it viable? Is it real? Is it going to happen? A lot of people have speculated, well, great if it happens, but I don't think it's going to because it just seems too good to be true. And fair enough, when something seems too good to be true, it often is. But I'd like to throw this into the mix. The first thing is that, is it actually sensible for any company to make a camera, a high-level camera, in the current environment? And one statistic that was brought to my attention was the fact that in terms of productions that make money, in terms of proper, full-on productions around the world, there are only 500 cameras, pretty much, in production globally. So for every feature film, there are obviously a few cameras used, but if you just add up major productions that are being done around the world, there's about 500 cameras in use at any one time. The market just isn't that big for another, you know, $350,000 camera. So if they were to produce a camera like RED that produced very high frame rates and compete directly with the current manufacturers, then they're not going to have a lot of sales. No matter what they do, they're not got a lot of impact. Of course, once you lower the price point dramatically, you open it up to a whole lot of different uses. You open it up everything from indie production to TV programs to sports programming to documentaries to a whole lot of things. So it's quite possible that this was actually a shrewd business decision, that the only way that they can make money on producing a camera like this is, in fact, to have a low price point and go for mass production. And I would suggest to you that it's probably no accident that they've done this. And when we were speaking to them, we got the impression they are, in fact, geared up for large-scale production.
We will be geared for mass production. We will be geared to handle the demand. And we are dealing with that from an early on standpoint. Luckily, the people that we work with and the people that are thinking about this, other than me, are pretty smart guys.
And how big is that development plan?
It's big. I'm not going to give you any numbers. I gave numbers once, and I was sort of off by an order of magnitude. Just depending on the given day, there's a lot of people working on this thing.
That was the voice of Ted Trilowitz, who is leader of the Rebellion from RED Camera, and we spoke to him, amongst other things, about how it was that the system was going to be able to record this data, because the flow of 4K data is effectively about a gigabyte a second, if my maths holds. And so what was going to happen with this? How are they going to record? And particularly, what were the options for recording? We're going to play you first a piece from the public announcement, where they discuss the ideas of the various drives that they're going to have. And then we asked Ted exactly, you know, how these were going to work in practice, especially as there were none there at NAB to actually look at.
Introducing RED Drive and RED Flash, RED's very own and affordable in-camera recording solution, each with strengths and advantages. The first onboard recording for 4K digital cameras.
So can you explain RED Flash?
A little bit. So the first caveat is that what you're seeing now is development curve. So I can give you our best attempts at where we know we're headed. There's 2.5-inch form factor unit. It's essentially our digital magazine. So it'll hold different types of drive technology. It'll hold a spinning drive, and it'll hold flash. And depending on what you need to shoot when, and the type of technology that does what, you have a choice as to what you want to put and how you want to use that magazine. Obviously, a spinning drive will cost less than flash memory, but they have different purposes, different speeds, different uses. So that's the logic behind it.
How much can you record on the flash?
Don't know yet. What we're estimating by the time we're done with our development year is that at 2K with lossless compression, visually lossless compression, we're targeting about an hour.
So visually lossless. Obviously, we're interested from a green screen point of view.
Yep.
Is it actually
444 most probably, 10-bit most probably.
So would you equate the compression to something like the mild compression that you see on a SR or the heavy compression you see on
Much more like
HDK.
The mild compression you'd see on an SR. Okay. Maybe even better.
So we got maybe an hour, maybe,
give or take.
I'd record.
Yep.
And the price that we heard outside, that's without any
Media. So there will be a recording solution for sub $1,000.
So, but theoretically, if I had an SR deck already, I could connect
sure.
the camera up.
Camera has dual link HDSDI, and you're ready to go.
Okay, and then other than the flash, what was the other option? The red drive,
which would be an off-board solution for 4K. So you're going to get up to 2K on the camera itself.
Yeah.
Totally portable, totally independent of anything. Then when you really wanted to go to use the full advantage of everything we got, now you're in 4K.
Okay.
And that's going to have some high-speed port on the camera, potentially InfiniBand or some next-generation high-speed data port. And that'll go to some external drive packs, and there'll be different form factors and speeds available to handle that.
And right there in that answer, you also have the reason why some people have raised an eyebrow over the red camera. Now, Ted was very generous with his time, and we mean no disrespect in saying this, but you'll notice in a lot of the answers either that we got or anybody else has got about the red camera, it isn't so much that the team won't tell you what they're doing, is it sounds like they haven't actually defined it yet. They're saying, we might do this, it could be that, it could be a next generation this. Well, maybe they're doing themselves a disservice, maybe they're just outfoxing us all, but it would seem that these things should be defined by now. Now let's think about this, and you can do the maths yourself. If you're going to have something mass-produced, and as we hear in a few minutes, that's mass-produced for release before this calendar year, and this interview was recorded at the end of April, beginning of May, there are 7 calendar months left to get the camera out. Now, wouldn't you think that a lot of these things, like the audio specs, like the specs to do with the output from the camera, would all need to have been defined? Because you have to presumably pick one, you then have to define it, design for it, build some prototypes, test it, get the design approved, release to manufacturing, then manufacturing has to gear up for mass production. And all of that seems like a big ask with everything else that they've got on their plate in just 7 months. Now, we have no inside knowledge, we have no basis for saying this, we're just pointing out that it's the responses that the Red have been making about, well, they could do this, they could do that, they're out there asking the market what it wants, that don't seem to sit well with some people with the timescale of presumably about 6 months to get the camera to market. It may just well be that the guys have once again outfoxing us and this is all well defined and they're just using us as a sounding board, but it's that particular issue, whether they can pull it off and whether they can pull it off in the time that has probably raised the most number of questions. The other thing, of course, is once you've got stuff captured by whatever means it is that they end up with, and I'm sure it'll work well, how are you going to use it in post-production? What's the pipeline of happening after you come off set? It's all very well capturing at 4K, but can I use the 4K? And if I can, how do I do it? And we asked that question to Ted.
So I get my 4K back, and I'm going to want to edit it on something.
Yep.
Who have you been talking to? What can you tell us about the people that work with
you? So my previous life at AJA, you probably heard of that company, linked very closely with Apple, and had a very good, successful run and sort of migrated to this with their full support and enthusiasm and excitement. They're actually going to be one of our development partners, and we're going to announce some things down the road that we're working together with AJA on, which nothing could make me happier than that. You can see today in the AJA booth, in the Apple booth, and in that little development room, 2K editorial in Final Cut Pro. So that supports DPX file format through the AJA translators. And so we're thinking about this workflow. There's a company called Assimilate that does software called Scratch, which is very data-centric, 2K, 4K. There's a company called Codex that actually was in there, and then they wanted to move outside of the room and go out to have a real booth, so they're in the central hall. 2K, 4K data recorder on the market today. So we're looking at who are the best of breed in these kind of companies that make sense. It doesn't mean this is the only companies we're going to support. It's just companies that I have comfort zone with that I think these are nice choices. And obviously there'll be plenty of other DI software, Mac and PC. There'll be other NLEs that we'll work to do our best to support. But from an Apple Final Cut standpoint, I have a lot of comfort there. And so it's an obvious link point for us.
What is the audio?
So we know we're going to do at least 4 channels of audio on board. It may be higher. We know we're going to do at least 24-bit, 48 kilohertz. It may be higher. So we know where our baseline is, and we're probably just going to go up from there. 96, 192, not out of the realm of possibility. More than 4 channels of audio on board, not out of the realm of possibility. There'll probably be off-board options for audio, too, an audio pack that we'll rig on the cage and work that way.
And so a lot of the skepticism that's been raised around the RED camera is simply seems too good to be true, and how are they going to do it that quickly? And this all pivots on the fact that at the moment we don't have any images ready. At the moment, we haven't actually seen any images from the RED camera. Having said that, the guys have assured us that they are actually filming stuff and testing the cameras in the lab, and it's all working well. So,
timetable. From an engineering perspective, remember, we're a development engineering process right now. We are targeting first shippable units before the end of this calendar year. That's an engineering target. Now, we're on target so far, but all the stars have to align completely throughout the years to hit that, throughout this year to hit that target. We're not going to say we're going to ship on this date and miss a target. That's for other companies to do. We're going to tell you this is what we're headed towards. We feel pretty good about this target, and we'll keep you posted on the website and through our messaging as we get closer to those targets.
Of course, only time will tell whether RED can pull it off. Every once in a while, a company does smash the glass ceiling and redefine a new price point for some part of our industry. And when that happens, it's remarkable. We certainly hope RED can do it. And we'll be following RED pretty closely over the coming year. So that's it for this week, this follow-up to NAB. Next week, we return to the normal style podcast. Just want to thank everybody who sent in emails. We got a heap of feedback from Vegas. Apparently, you like hearing us drunk, which is good. Also I'd like you to check out fxphd.com, our new training site that runs alongside FX Guide. FX Guide has tips and tricks and news and stuff, and PhD is a much more focused attempt to really take your knowledge to the next level. We cover everything from editing and Final Cut Pro right through visual effects, Toxic, Flame, Shake, and we'll be doing color grading and a bunch of other really, really great stuff coming out. I just want to thank everybody for the phenomenal response we've had to the launch of FXPhD. We kind of hit our 3-month targets in about, I think, something like 3 days. So it's been great. We're camped out in the forums there if you'd like to talk to us. And as always, if you have any ideas for future podcasts or things you'd like us to look at, please email us either at FXGuide or at FXPhD.com.
Thanks for listening to this week's FX Podcast. Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by using the Contact Us links at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright 2006 FX Guide LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide LLC.